tearjerkers because they had an awful lot of problems. Did you find that was still the case, or has that changed?
Well, the same kind of problem always turned up. The exchange committee always got these letters about it. Failure to receive postage. And sometimes there had to be some sort of arbitrary way of assigning material that was wanted by more than one person. And so finally they evolved this system whereby one library got first choice on one list, and the next list they got the last choice. First choice.
Gosh, well, it certainly has, while you were president, it came up again, so you certainly had to deal with it.
That's one of the things that I was most fortunate in, that Louise Darling was willing to accept the chairmanship. Uh-huh.
Now, was that when you were vice president that she became?
No, that was a special committee.
That was okay.
And that was during my term as president.
As president. And what year was it you became president?
72.
78. And your favorite meeting when they ran out of the hors d'oeuvre.
Yes. That Seattle will always be remembered.
Well, what were. Talk about some of the main issues while you were president.
Well, I can remember one problem we were having was with the certification, with the accreditation of programs. Each program had to be inspected by a member of the committee. And there was difficulty in being sure that one person can represent the interests of the organization, and even with a continuing committee, this chairman usually has to do a great deal of this.
This is accreditation of the courses taught in library schools.
There was some problem over one of them that the board first took down and then finally accepted because it found the criteria it was using were not actually in the statement of the requirements for a medical library course. And of course the courses were very uneven to begin with, because sometimes it was a course in bibliography of science, and sometimes it was a long or short or intermediate. And finally the board agreed that until certification code was presented and accepted, that any course that would be accepted, that according to the programs, didn't have to be vetted.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the details now, but there was a great deal of confusion over that, naturally.
Yes, I would expect some people wouldn't receive that very well. I'll continue asking you some questions about your tenure as MLA president. One of the things you commented upon while you were president was that the attendance at the business meetings was, as usual, deplorable. Has this been true since you first joined in 1946?
More than once. The sergeant at arms has had to be sent out to collect people from the corridors to get a quorum. Depends a bit on the timing of the meeting.
Uh-huh.
And different patterns have been followed. I don't know whether it's better now, but on the final Friday afternoon meeting, I think members go up, they have their hair done for the banquet, and many people feel that it's even is their business, it is necessary for them to be there because they can vote by mail on a good many things. And also, you know, there's a large apathetic group that doesn't want to bother with it.
Obviously, though, you think it's important. Can you comment on some reasons why you think?
Well, it's this is, after all, the heart of your is determines where the association goes and what it does with its time and its money, how it's constructed. Bylaws changes can be very important for the future. I just think if you won't belong to anything, you have a responsibility to belong to it wholly.
I think sometimes there's a tendency for members to think that really the president or the board had already decided that. Could you comment on what kind of powers the president does have? When you held the office, did you think you actually had control, or were you limited?
No, I felt that I was just another member who happened to be in the chair. Because the board does make the decisions. Very often they follow the recommendations of the committees, very often they accept this is true of any political activity. But the president, of course, carries on a lot of activity, lots of correspondence, and is prepared to make recommendations, but the president doesn't actually have a vote except the tiebreaker. Some people work more by consensus than others, I must admit. I remember the story of a faculty member at Harvard meeting another faculty member in the yard. He said, "You didn't go to faculty member meeting?" He said, "No, I don't believe in interfering with President Lowell's private business." That's the way some people feel about their organization. When there is anything really crucial, more attendance. I know the admission of the osteopathic library is to membership. Some people felt very strongly about, but that happened to come up fairly late in the private business meeting, and they missed the meeting. So it serves them right.
I don't remember that. What about what year was that?
I don't recall. I wasn't on the board then.
I hope I wasn't one of the people that missed the meeting
years ago.
Did you feel during your year as president that you were presiding over a stormy sea, or were things relatively calm during that period?
No, a good many things happened. It got bumpier as we went along, because that was the year that von Braun-Schmidt resigned.
Uh-huh.
And we had first, of course, the search committee, of which you're... Ross Glenn Brudvig was chairman.
Uh-huh.
He did a very good job of it. After all, this was only our second, would be our second executive secretary. And committees of the board had to write up the list of requirements, specifications for the search committee to work on, have interviews. So we would go into executive session to interview, and then Schmidt would come back as secretary and take some more minutes, and would go into executive session again to discuss it. It was a very administratively a kind of rocky time.
You were telling me this morning about how that some of that evolved, that the executive secretary changed.
I knew there had been criticism on the board, and when we were at a meeting, I mentioned to Helen Schmidt that there had been some criticism. I was afraid something might come up. And she just said, "Well, I resign." She wasn't willing to take that kind of criticism. We had expected her to stay on for a couple of years until her normal retirement date.
especially the young people, they always want to go faster than any organization is able to do. And they felt that they were not sharing. There's always the feeling that important decisions are being made and nobody tells me these things. Some of them wanted the association to go in different directions. And they felt that the process was very slow. But this is inevitable. And we did make a definite effort to bring energetic young people in. But there's some committees, these standing committees that progress from the newest appointee to the chairman of the committee. You have to be sure that the people you are appointing are going to be able to take first the time and the labor involved in being chairman of one of these important committees with a lot of correspondence or for instance, the certification committee, a lot of certificates to handle. And it's fatal if you get somebody in there who doesn't. The first nominating committee went into this quite innocently. We had no rules to follow. So we met a couple of times and presented some names and voted on them. The procedure is very much more elaborate now and much more thorough, much more conscientious. Each person has to present whatever nominations he wishes to present with supporting data. And the nominees from the groups also have to be inserted into this. And there's some very different. The groups are likely to nominate very established people in their groups. So those have been given us some very hard, wise hints. And the thorough canvassing is indicated by the quality of nominees we've been getting.
Problems have risen because the committee is so large now?
No, they all attend, and it means two or three long sessions. They take that post very seriously. And I'm sure it's a much healthier arrangement than it used to be with the nominating committee, with a new person or so coming on every year and then proceeding up to the chairmanship. You don't have as much continuity on the committee, but you have very experienced people serving, so that their background it averages out.
Of all your MLA work, which did you like best? Which gave you the most satisfaction?
Well, I think probably the public meetings and the writing. That's an ability to talk to the whole membership and to talk frankly about our problems and try to persuade people that we were not being secretive about them and that we were members together of an organization that utilized whatever skills we could offer. I can't think of any one activity that gave me the most satisfaction. I enjoyed working on the exchange committee. I enjoyed most the practical things that you could do something about rather than the more philosophical and theoretical ones. That's not my best advice.
You did mention that one of the things that you felt best about was the appointment of the certification of Louise Darling.
Louise Darling. I was very happy that she was willing to take the code to the revision. You see, we had had a couple of efforts by committees previously that were not acceptable. Accepted. And so this was a kind of last-ditch effort. Louise had more experience probably in all of these preparatory committees than anybody in the organization and had been more deeply concerned with teaching herself. And another appointment that I was very happy with was Bob Lewis as the bulletin. was invited to be present at board meetings. I should imagine there was a lot of repetitious talk that was boring, but still it was important that the bulletin editor be up on what was going on.
Where the association was heading. Mm-hmm. I can see that. During your year as president, you traveled a lot more than most of the presidents.
Well, it was agreed that the vice president and the president should go. One or the other should be represented at each regional meeting.
Uh-huh.
Now, I went to, for instance, to the continuation committee meeting in Boston because the chairman wasn't, liaison officer wasn't able to go and ask me to take over that. So that was that was one trip. I don't think I went more often than most. It just happened that there was a carryover. I didn't go to very many one year, but I did more the next.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's very important for the officers to be visible, and more recently they've been speaking about the association at these regional meetings.
Uh-huh.
This is an important tie.
Did you think the fact that you were retired?
Well, it certainly gave me more freedom to take my time. There are two sides to that. It's almost a full-time job. Either you have a job with staff who can job while you're gone, and with excellent secretarial help. My problem at Lubbock was that we had a continuing change in the secretarial help, and I couldn't just hand something over since in this all the board, because letters today, Bishop, were still going to Montreal, and different people they hadn't caught up with because the directory was not updated. But there is also the question of energy, and I'm not entirely sure that people near the end of their professional careers are the best ones as president. They have a certain amount of wisdom, but they lack a certain amount of drive. And as you see, that retirement, at least you're building up toward retirement, you begin to look forward to that more than you do to what's going to happen to the association next year. In other words, there's the feeling that you won't be around in an administrative position to take advantage of the decisions that are made, or to see what comes up.
As you look back on your MLA years, are there things that you would do differently?
No, given the circumstances. I would like to have been able to give more energy to the association. In the early years particularly, it was a continual battle of a wish that certain things should be done and the personal energy to pursue them. I was always interested in the gathering of information, statistical compilations and so on, but I wasn't able to help with that because down at home.
Mm-hmm. In those early years in MLA, we touched on the fact that they met jointly with the American Association of History of Medicine. It seemed there were many medical librarians who were interested in medical history. Why do you think this was so at that time?
Well, the medical librarian is the generalist on the staff,
mm-hmm.
and really has to look forward to what any given library is going to need in the future. Also, librarians are instinctively acquisitive, and everyone has some older material, hangs on to that, and appreciates gifts. So it's partly a function of collection building, and partly a function, of course, of being required to know a little something about everything.
Do you think the interest in the history of medicine is fading among the MLA membership?
Well, there are two aspects of that. One, I think there are getting to be more people responsible for appointed as librarians of history collections.
Mm-hmm.
I think they are considered much better trained than any of us, most of us were. And so you have a more concentrated group interested in history of medicine, whereas the others, members more or less relinquish it because they're interested in some of the newer aspects.
And do you think this is reflected in the fact that the Bulletin publishes fewer articles?
No, I think it's the other way around, that they publish fewer articles because fewer are submitted there, fewer people to feed articles to. And of course, they don't get the contributions from the doctors who used to belong. A great many of those contributions were papers given at meetings, particularly in the city where the meeting was held. I know this piece I did on the history of the association at the Minneapolis meeting several years ago, I ended with a quotation from Guy Stanton Ford, who had spoken to the association when it met in St. Paul some years before.
Was he president of our university?
I think he wasn't at the time. I said that he reminds us that history is not a conservative subject, and if it teaches anything, it teaches constant change. I do not think any man fully grasps all that his profession means, the sense of all that is behind him, and the importance of what he is and what he does, unless he knows the long road traveled by all those on whose shoulders he stands today. That, of course, could be a text for any medical, young medical librarian.
Your history, the direction of your interest turned toward building a historical collection here rather than writing history of medicine. How did that come
well,
about?
Well, I'm really not trained to be a history of medicine. I haven't, what I've learned, I've learned from reading myself. Going to lectures, my knowledge is bibliographical, and I couldn't speak with any depth. I did report to the local medical history seminar on the Sotheby, some aspects of the Sotheby collection purchases. I'm sure I could write something in the way of local history, but again, the commitment isn't there to spend that much time on any one topic. My strength and also my weaknesses and a capacity to take an interest in any number of things. And I haven't been willing to commit myself wholly to any one
thing. When did your interest in the history of medicine begin?
Well, as I say, I've always been interested in unusual and in rare books. And my father had some rather interesting ones. And I was custodian of this William Snow Miller collection, which was in a closet for many years because we had no place to put it. I did have to service that when people needed to have some knowledge of the contents. And we did some purchasing of historical books, and we received a number of very fine gifts. And also, with the appointment of Dr. Erwin Ackerknecht as the first professor of the history of medicine here, he was the department. We had active publishing historian rather than amateurs to serve. And this made quite a bit of difference. He was extremely generous in helping in reading book catalogs. As you know, they're millions of dollars than reading catalogs day after day. But
I disagree with that.
Well, if you're actively searching for certain things, but I'm looking at it from the point of view of a librarian. This was a treat for me, but it also gets to be a burden when you don't have time to follow up. I was doing too many other things.
It definitely is time consuming.
But for faculty members, it is considered rather a burden to read book catalogs. So he was extremely helpful in building both our classical and our kind of more recent collection. We owe very fine collection of French clinical school and a good deal of material also on public health. Because our most valuable collections previously had been in anatomy, he commented that he'd always been haunted by the bones because he'd been at the American Museum of Natural History before he came here. And where he was, he found the anatomy books.
That's amazing.
But we have a great proportion of the major books of anatomy. Few titles we don't have.
So he had quite an influence then on the
yes, course, William Snow, or Snow Miller, started the medical history seminar, it was back in the teens.
Mm-hmm.
And those people, he was a martinet. He was a lung specialist.
Mm-hmm.
Just over in the anatomy. And everyone who belonged to this seminar, and it was an honor, was required to submit a paper every year or two in advance. Dr. Miller, being deaf, sat and read the paper while it was being presented. Well, by the time I was the first woman invited to join, and by the time I joined, the numbers had dwindled considerably.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it just faded out because the session, there might be 3, 4, 6 people at the session, and it just wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And people weren't contributing papers. It just died of inanition. No, that was it sort of faded away just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Dr. Rissa and Dr. Numbers did their best for it, but it just didn't seem to be appealing to enough people. And the old timers retired. Nobody came in to take their place.
Dr. Akernicht eventually went back to Germany?
Yes, he went to the Institute of the History of Medicine at Zurich, which is one of the famous schools. And he had quite a large group of graduate students. Many dissertations came out of there, many publications. He had charge of the museum as well as the library.
Was there a lull then, or was there another history of
that? Well, we had a whole history, a whole series of lectures. Dr. Gunter Rott was to be a permanent staff member, but he came in under national protocols. We had signed up to go back to Germany for a year or two after having this particular fellowship. So I think he was a little fearful of the permanency of the position because it had been under gift money. He was afraid the medical school might not maintain it. Well, of course, they have and increased it.
Uh-huh.
But he went to Nuremberg. Then we had several lectures. Dr. Walter Arkeld was here a couple of years. And then Dr. Nicholas Mani was appointed. He was a thorough scholar. But he went to Bonn. I think he decided that he hadn't been here enough years to build up much of an annuity. And Bonn got a retirement.
Uh-huh.
That was partly it was a prestigious appointment. Major part of the historical works of pharmacy are in the Memorial Library. That was an accident of space, largely. And the Memorial Library also has a fine basic science historical collection with a science bibliographer. And altogether, these departments make, I think, the largest teaching department in the country in history of science, because they have the basic science, biology, and the chemistry is concerned with it also. But the collections are somewhat dispersed because we certainly wouldn't have room for all of those that are in the main library, and I think they worked out a very comfortable arrangement with the Memorial Library. This book that was published, this bibliography of books that was published by John Nye some years ago, of course, is very much outdated because our whole the Sotheby purchases were all subsequent.
Still a classic in the field. In the early years, where did you find the money to acquire new materials?
Well, I can remember getting it, and we didn't have an early edition of Harvey. We spent $300, I think, for a copy of fairly early edition of it.
Uh-huh.
And at that dream of. It's very beautifully selected collection. And he also left his money to part to Johns Hopkins and part of it to us for the library and the history of medicine. So we do have a fund which is very helpful in the interest that's used for current purchases.
And so before that, you were kind of just squeezing things out of the regular budget, but now you have a special fund. Do you have other special funds?
Oh, we have some. Sometimes the funds are given in honor of certain memorials for certain doctors. Dr. Middleton, he was responsible for most of the contributions. He had, as the chief anonymous donor, he would drop the checks that were given to him. We had them added up in the course of the year. We had a fund bought some anesthesia things from Sotheby's sales. And our major fund for the purchase of the Edinburgh collection came from a gift of one of Dr. Middleton's patients. He added a codicil to his will, and so we got a nice chunk of money there. Some of it was used to furnish the building, but there was a nucleus left. It wasn't tremendous, but it was a solid money that I could use at discretion.
So you've never had a formal friends group?
We do have one. Chauncey Leake sent us a check some years ago to Friends of the Library, and that sort of started. That's the fund we use that we drop things into now. He was a former faculty member here.
It's difficult to raise money in Wisconsin. Isn't there a state law that you're not allowed to solicit funds for the university?
I don't know about that, but I do know you have to clear the university administration so that you don't have too many requests. The alumni got permission to collect the building, but I wouldn't have been permitted to go out and collect to ask to solicit anybody for money, because they have to predetermine what campaigns they're going to support.
Did you find that as the collection grew, it became easier to get money? People were more likely to donate?
Well, I'm sure that builds up. But we don't have nearly the build-up that they have, for instance, in Yale, where probably every gift is held four times over.
Yeah.
But we do get some very unexpected gifts. Most of them, of course, are run-of-the-mill libraries given by the widows.
A few treasures tucked away here and there.
Yeah.
You mentioned that Dr. Akernick did help select materials for the library. Did any of the other scholars that followed him, or were you mostly choosing him during that?
Well, I pretty much kept it up, and I was quite flattered that Dr. Imani said that the selection, he had been a book selector for the University Library at Baird.
Oh.
And he said the selection was of professional caliber, and I felt quite good about it. But, of course, I was following along with the interests that we had there in the department, the people that had in the department. I think the interests had changed quite a bit, and I wouldn't be capable now of selecting wisely for their present needs, because I haven't been in on the build-up. They're more interested in contemporary 19th century medicine. But they are doing it on the basis of the strong basic collection that exists.
Those books that you are acquiring or are getting as gifts, who passed?
strategy for us.
Through the years, how have you handled the reference questions, circulation people want to take?
Well, they just had to go through circulation and get to the room was kept locked unless there was somebody here. We have most of the time had at least a halftime person assigned, but it hasn't been possible to. Little bit of something about the possible research in this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. vacation.